Welcome to Shooting Spaces, a real estate photography podcast. Discussions on gear, technique, industry news, and interviews with the best in the business. Now, here are your hosts, Rich Baum and Brian Berkowitz.
Hi, this is Rich Baum from Sacramento, California.
And Brian Berkowitz out of New York.
And we want to welcome you to Shooting Spaces, a real estate photography podcast. And this is kind of a bi-coastal California, New York thing. And how you doing today, Brian?
Not bad. Things are picking up. It's been busy.
Yeah, me too. What's the weather? What's the weather been like? You got any tornadoes or hurricanes or anything happening? Nor'easters?
No. We had a couple of nor'easters the last few weeks, but we're in the mid to high 40s, so we're picking up a little, and shoots are coming in, so the season starting to turn a little bit.
And I know last week I beat out three rain events for Twilights, and I was so surprised I got them all.
Every time I spoke to you last week, you were trying to get to the shoot before the rain came.
Yeah, but it all worked out, so I have another one after this, so going out after our interview to... shoot another Twilight.
Wow. And you're busy and you got workshop this week. You got everything going on.
Yeah, I got my workshop next week. Oh, this week, Wednesday. So up in Auburn, California, I'm really looking forward to that. Good group of people. So, I'd like to take this opportunity to welcome our guest. And I want to call it like our secret guest is the guy that I look upon. If anyone, I look upon his work, his advice, everything he is about. I think he's the top in the business, in my opinion. But he's a great guy. I've known him for a few years, and everybody seems to know him in the groups and also the PFRE group. But I'd like to introduce Wayne Capelli to our podcast. Hello, Wayne.
Hi.
Good. I assume you're having a beautiful day out, and you're in Monterey, right? Monterey, California?
I'm in Carmel, California, and I'm in the midst of a beautiful day before the rains come. So I did four houses today and pretty much canceled the next couple of days. And I'm going to be just goofing around the studio.
Wow. Yeah. You have a studio. I've been seeing your studio, and you've been a photographer for a long time. So do us a favor first. What's your business, the name of your business, and how can people find you? And tell us where's your background and what's your emphasis and what are you doing in photography?
I am in Carmel, California. My business name is Interface Visual. And it's interesting that I've been in business for 40 years. And when I used the name Interface Visual all those years ago, it was one of those names that people would go, what the hell is that? So now in the high tech thing, it's actually a pertinent name as a photography studio. I started my photography business when I was in high school, and I was learning how to do black and white printing. And the portrait photographer, the big portrait photographer at the time, came to the yearbook. And as he was walking out, I asked him if he needed an assistant. And he said, you know, do you know how to print black and white? And I said, you know, being I was in high school and I actually did 2 weeks of learning how to print black and white in high school, I thought I did know how to print black and white. So, of course, I said, yes, I did. And I was actually paid by the image that I printed, not by the hour. And I was there for a whole weekend printing several hundred pictures, and they were awful. And he actually threw them back in my face. And, you know, he goes, I thought you knew what to do. And so that started me to understand the difference between taking pictures and producing professional level work. So what happened was he taught me how to print black and white at a professional level. And this is now 1974, and I started to learn how to do black and white, and I actually wanted to learn how to print black and white better. And so he said, well, if you really want to do this, you really should learn you really should contact the old man in Carmel. And I go, okay. So he calls him up, and the old man in Carmel in 1974 was Ansel Adams. So, and And then it was like, he was very accessible then. Everybody knew him. You could talk to him on the street in Carmel. So I took a couple of workshops from him, met his printers and got to work with him to develop, you know, just to learn the basics of photography. But also in Carmel was, Morley Bear and Cole Weston and Brett Weston. So, you know, I had an amazing people that you could hang out with and ask and learn. So, yeah. So what happened was then I started doing one of these kind of things where Ansel asked me, well, what do you want to take pictures of? And I was in high school. I was taking pictures. I want to take pictures of girls. And so he goes, well, Ken Marcus at the time was doing Playboy and did a lot of their gatefold things. So I actually went and took a workshop from Ken Marcus on doing Playboy quality nudes, which at the time in high school, I thought that was like the coolest thing. But what I realized is it was the absolute worst thing to do if you wanted to take pictures of women, because once you got to the level that you're not worried about the naked woman, you're worried about the lighting, you're worried about the presentation, you're worried about all these other things that take away you're worried about lighting and composition and the final output. So, and that's how I started learning. I consider myself more a portrait photographer more than anything now.
I'm looking at your website now, and it looks like you have, you know, tons of different sections devoted to different type of work: architectural, portrait, wedding, events. So you do a little food and wine. So you do a little bit of everything.
Well, see, the thing is, I just love taking pictures, and I consider myself a photographer more than a real estate photographer or a commercial photographer. When I first started my business, I opened it up with a graphic design firm, which became an ad agency. So our first clients were a fruit company and a font company, which were Apple and Adobe. And it's like, remember back now, it's like, ooh, you did work for Apple. Ooh, you did work for Adobe. No, back in the 70s and early 80s, they were, you know, Adobe did fonts. They didn't do Photoshop. Apple was doing not anything like they were doing now, but as clients and at the beginning of the digital revolution in imaging and just the digital revolution, I was fortunate enough to be part of that sphere of influence on the way we took pictures. You know, back in, God, we did something for Apple a long, long time ago at a worldwide developer conference. And this is when we were shooting, everybody was still shooting slide film. And the big presentations at the time were 20 projectors with hundreds of slides interacting with each other, you know, with movies and stuff like that. But what they did was we scanned in all the images. We scanned in movies and video. And instead of 20 or 30 projectors, they did it with a single projector, and the whole presentation was with all the hundreds of pictures and the images was on a gold CD. And I knew that this was that all the things that we learned on film, all the things that we've been doing is going to change forever. And, you know, I was just fortunate to be a part of it.
Wow. Just I can't get over Ansel Adams. I'm sorry, you had me there.
No, but see, and actually, again, I come from Carmel, and really everybody knew him, and everybody knew and interacted with these really world famous photographers. And there's a thing about taking pictures that the height of your, it's like if you're really good, that you become a professional photographer. But when you're around people that are highly creative and they're really good photographers and they're not professional, it changes your scope on how you do things, because mm-hmm. It's like, yes, yes, I'm a professional photographer, but there are, quote, amateur photographers that kick my ass. You know, I don't understand how they see things. I don't, their thought processes are amazing, but they're not professionals. So, you know, that's the mindset that we have as photographers.
Yeah, I was very fortunate to be growing up in the movie industry for so many years that I just had to get so competent at what I was doing.
Absolutely. And it was, what's amazing is, and to bring it full circle with my thing with Apple, I mean, with that digital, that disc, that was like 30 years ago, is that what I didn't realize is that I would actually be considered a photographer, that I would be making money, and I'm not producing anything. You know, I don't give prints out. We don't do that anymore. We essentially take pictures, we put it on the web, we get money for the work that we do, but, you know, a big magnet on our hard drives, our work is gone.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting that that we actually can make money and not produce anything.
Not producing anything physical.
No, not producing anything physical. But, you know, it's like a decade ago when my mother passed away, you know, she had a big box of pictures underneath her bed that we all went through, that, you know, we kind of divvied them up, or we did that. But now if something happens, I mean, no one can get on my hard drives because they're encrypted. You know, so it's one of those things that as photographers and as creatives that we should print stuff.
Hmm. Yeah. I don't do enough printing. So,
well, okay. Here's my thing. You know, if you wanted to ask how to get better at what we do, print stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is if you go through the steps on calibrating your monitor and getting prints that are really good, what happens is your color in your work becomes more consistent because you're not relying on a monitor.
Mm-hmm.
You actually have a consistent light source because, you know, when we look at monitors, they change, all these things change, but when we look at a print, even if the light is different, our eyes adjust that we know that the color is right on pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And also, when you're doing your portfolio, you know, you should print out the 20 or 30 pictures and kind of live with them for a while, and mark them up, because you can actually, for some reason, you can see things more on a print than you can even on a big screen. So, you know, live with them, mark them up, make the changes. It's like, this is too blue, this is too red. It doesn't matter what it looks like on your screen. When you start making those corrections from the print, you don't really need a color-corrected monitor because what the file produces is what the file produces.
And I think it forces you to criticize yourself in a different way than if you were just looking at the monitor. You know, when I look at my printed portfolio, I look at it very differently than when I'm looking at the same images on screen.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And as far as marketing goes, I did a presentation for the state of California, and they wanted to, we did a portfolio review, and instead of the projector in the boardroom, I printed, you know, 20 by 24s and just put them out and threw them on the table so they could actually look at them. So, you know, it's a nicer way of getting people to really look at your work.
Yeah.
Speaking of getting people to look at your work, I know you shared with me two of your Flickr channels that you have. Do you want to tell us a little bit about those?
Yeah. What I on Facebook and all these other places, people always ask, you know, what should I do? And it's kind of like, well, as photographers, we really should just post pictures all the time. You know, it's you're really not a photographer if you're not if you're not sharing your work. And although the new, you know, as from your SEO thing, I actually put just my name and my phone number and everything on all the pictures that I put out. So when you do meta searches online, although it's not going to your particular website, it hits your name. So if you have thousands of pictures on the internet, that's just a big net that when people do searches, will find you.
Yeah, if you search for me, I got a lot of stuff out there. So yeah. I don't print it, but it's out there. So I'm not guilty of not getting my work out there. Wayne, can I ask you a question? Well, we're kind of on the same lines, and I find that you hit something really important, a subject that we're too much shooting our equipment. We're shooting settings, shooting lighting. This is my opinion, shooting lighting. We're not touching base with, if we're shooting a wedding, it takes a while before we start really connecting with the subject, which is the same as a model, which is basically the same as a house.
Right.
How do you go in, and when you're walking into a house from outside in, and then before you start shooting, what are your thought processes and what are you thinking about, you know, how to go about what you're going, or are you just starting to shoot?
Well, here's the thing. What happens is real estate photographers, I think Sam used the word luxury, but instead of luxury, what I'm going to take it back a step is when we shoot, there are some houses, a predominant amount of houses that we shoot are for shelter. These are primary residences that people will live in and put their furniture in, as opposed to non-shelter houses where this is probably a second or third home that they aren't going to live there. So these houses normally aren't cluttered, normally have nicer furniture simply because they're not using it. They don't actually live there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you walk into a home that the family is going to live in, it's going to sell, people are going to move in there, you know, you have to show the house. You have to show the size, the room, and those kind of things. But I walk in like a dinner guest, kind of like first you want to find the living room because that's where you're going to be. You want to find the kitchen, and you want to find the bathroom because, well, you're going to have to go later on, and everything else. And those are the areas that you go to when you go to somebody's house. You don't necessarily go into the bedrooms. You don't go into their bedrooms because those are private spaces. So the way, and normally living rooms, kitchens, actually kind of interact with each other are normally connected to a dining room. So, you know, I want to show how they would work through how you interact through those spaces. And then you go into the bedrooms and then the bathrooms.
And as far as, are you a tweaker or a mover of furniture or props or anything like that? Or do you shoot it exactly as it is?
Real estate
shoots.
I am really, 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 really fortunate that 90% of the agents that I shoot for are very anal and have the house ready for me to shoot when I get there.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, but if I have to move something, I will, you know, cause sometimes people leave things or, you know, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But the rule of thumb is I won't touch anything sticky or wet.
But to camera though, moving like you're in a corner, you've got a chair there. Will you move the chair 6 inches one way or the other?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because, you know, considering a lot of times if you have to do that, you normally have to move the chair to get behind the chair anyways, to get that mm-hmm. angle. So,
yeah.
I also think things look different on camera. You usually shoot from angles that people don't normally look at rooms at. So,
yes.
You know, when people set up their furniture, whether they do it themselves or have a designer, it's obviously not ideal when you squeeze yourself into a corner of a room and try to shoot from that angle.
Yes. And also as real estate photographers, how do you know that the house that you're in is staged?
I know the staging furniture very, very well.
Or there's no TV. there's talking and conversation area. And I'm like, and you walk around the house going, there is no TV in this house. This house is
interesting.
I went to a house today. I shot at 2 o'clock my time on New York, and I didn't take my first shot till 2:50, a little over 45 minutes. I had the realtor restaging the whole house for me.
Oh my God. How did you do
this? Yes. But you know what? It was the first time I shot with her, and she's a very big agent out here in New York City. So I dealt with it, but for future shoots, I'm going to have to nicely set her straight.
Well, you know, that is my worst nightmare is the, okay, we're going to have to clean the rooms before, just let us know where we're going to go. Cause we're going to clean the rooms before you go to the next one. And you kind of go, okay, I'm going to be here for a while. But
well, the worst part was that the house was immaculate. She was just very particular about what she wanted. And, you know, everything had to be, she didn't bring anything extra. Everything just had to be shifted a little bit this way or that way to,
That's also my favorite thing. So I get this with agents a lot, and where they go, wait, I have to move the pillow. And after all, you have to say the words, no, you have to look at it from camera position. You can't look at it from across the room over there. Of course, it's going to be different. You know, no, I can't see the thing that's behind the couch that you can see and things like that. So, yeah. So, you know, they let them give them the iPad. Let them. Well, but then again, I do a lot of shoots with the iPad or with my phone and do a visual walkthrough. So we kind of get the angles so they can kind of go through to see if they have to do anything to the room before I run through the house.
So you're actually just taking pictures with the iPad or showing them the iPad as you do your walkthrough?
Absolutely.
Interesting.
It's like, you know, okay, this is here. Because what happens is, you know, the most frustrating email or text is, you know, did you get the closet next to the, I'm like, no, I didn't. But if they know, but like I said, if they get to see where I'm kind of saying, they can make suggestions like, you know, oh, you're not showing the window over there or those kind of things. And then, and they can make mental notes of things that they have to change. So I can start at one part of the house and they can do the things that they want to from the shot list. And it also, it also prevents me from overshooting or undershooting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm guilty of overshooting way too often. Let me ask you, Wayne, I want to just move off a little bit. And not that I wanted to spend a lot of time on equipment, but because most everybody knows pretty much what you're shooting anyway, because I don't think there's anybody more forthcoming than you are about what works for you. But what could you tell somebody getting into this or someone moving up? What piece of equipment or and it could be computer, it could be anything, tripod, camera, lens, but or education. What would you suggest to people? That would be something for them to think about. What's really important that they might be missing?
Take an art class. Equipment-wise. Okay, so I obviously switched over to the A6000 a couple of years ago, and it was really a fluke. I bought an A5100 at Best Buy for like $200, and it didn't have an EVF, but you know, I put it on a pole. It had Wi-Fi, and I thought it was really cool. And so when the A6000 came out, which had the EVF, I bought that because you know it was still cool. But what happens is when I started working with the EVF, I began to realize how old I was getting. That I have problems focusing a wide angle on a digital SLR. That zoom, that just simply being able to zoom in on an EVF 16 power is amazing. And working with tilt shift lenses, an EVF actually has and will actually preview the depth of field that you're shooting. So what happens is once you focus, you can actually critically focus the tilt shift lens and actually use the shift part more because you don't want to go to F11. So you can actually preview those things. Also, in judging exposures, I on one of the memories, I actually go black and white, so I can actually preview my room, so I can actually see the luminance in the room in black and white, which is amazing. It changes, you know, it's like, oh yeah, this white, this highlight's going to blow out. This black in color looks like it's really dark, but when you look at it in the luminance channel, you realize, you know what, there's still going to be detail there. So I'm not going to screw around with the exposure because of the way the color image looks in the screen.
Mm-hmm. Great. So using, utilizing the electronic viewfinder and taking our class, electronic viewfinder and black and white.
Yeah. And also, you know, one of the things about the A6000 is although we're professional photographers, the most important pictures to me are my family, my nieces and nephews and things like that. All the things that we take pictures of professionally. Yes, we use the big cameras, but in my world, the most important pictures are my personal pictures. And once I started taking the A6000 as a personal camera, I got to take it everywhere. I, you know, went to Hawaii. My friend had his digital SLR and left it in the room, left it in the car, just didn't take it. And so it had that kind of thing when I started using it, doing real estate photography, because at the A6000 at the time, you can get them at $450. You know, it's like you would have your camera and backup, and you know, you're there for $1,500, $2,000. That's great.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the A6000. Spent all day with it. So
yes, and there's also a kind of freedom. Like I had it on a pole, and it almost fell. And you know, you kind of hold your breath. But at the same time, if it would have fell and if it would have broken, it's like you kind of go damn. But you know, you go to Best Buy or someplace and you go buy another one, as opposed to if it was like my A7 R3 with the 12-24 and $5,000 broke, you know, it's kind of like, yeah, that's a different, you know, it's a different mindset on how you use your equipment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to ask you, Wayne, because I know Rich mentions this all the time. You know, I think this is our 12th or 13th podcast, and probably five or six of them, Rich has mentioned that he owes all the credit to you for his window pull darken method. And I know that because of you and then because of Rich, dozens and dozens of people use that. So tell me how that whole came about and how you discovered this. Because I'm curious to know.
Again, remember, I've been using Photoshop since the very, very beginning. So I'm very fluent in channel operations before there was all these other kind of things. And it was just one of the blend modes that I used. You know, it's one of those things in Photoshop that is there seriously, I thought that everybody knew.
Sure. I think the blend modes are one of the most underutilized features in Photoshop for the different layers.
Absolutely. You know, it's like people are trying to align things. Well, you know, use difference and you can actually see which layers are off. Or if you want to, instead of darken mode, if you're using flash and you want to blend the flash mode with an ambient, use multiplies and it will actually give you a nicer blend within the windows if you have slats and things like that. Also, here's something. Everybody uses a lot of people use the eyedropper because, you know, it gives you white, it gives you gray, and it gives you black. But what happens is, and let's say that you're using a gray card. Well, your gray card is not, I don't know what the gray levels are, But gray cards or other color patches actually have calibrated numbers, like black is actually 250, 253, whatever those values are. In Photoshop, and the default ones are 0, half, and then black. So that's absolute white, absolute black. Well, you can actually go into your curves and adjust the white points. You can adjust the eyedroppers so they match your calibrator. So when you push gray, it actually will match the gray that's on your card. Because there's no sense in using a calibrated card if it's not reading the numbers properly.
I think that's important because, you know, you mentioned it before briefly about having a calibrated monitor when you're talking about printing a little bit, but, you know, you keep emphasizing how essential that is to make sure your monitor is calibrated, and I couldn't agree with you more. So,
well, and that's what I mean. What happens is when you start doing the calibration process, and you are, and well, here's the thing. One of the things about calibration is a lot of people calibrate their monitors, but do not calibrate their monitors to a print source. And although the numerically your monitor is, let's, you know, is calibrated, unless it's calibrated to a print source, it's just a pretty monitor. You know, you will still get people that go, your pictures look, your files look wild. You're, you know, it's white. It's too green. It's too, because you're calibrating the look of your monitor, but you're really not doing anything to your files. But if you go through the whole process of print calibration, it actually changes the files and, you know, casts and hues and things like that.
Wow. That's great stuff, Wayne. I could see an interview with you going on 2-3 hours with just some of the information that you have. And you really, I love the, I'm, you got me thinking so much about an art class or, you know, just really thinking outside the box on how to get better. Well, and how to do
that. Or start doing portraits. That's actually, instead of an art class, start taking portraits. Here's how I think. When I do a house, the subject is something that you have to light. You have to pick something in a room. You have to actually identify the subject, the place that I want you to go to in the room. That would be the equivalent of taking pictures of a person. And it's like, if you were taking pictures of a person, even if the lighting was good and even if the exposure was perfect, if the expression on her face or his face is pleasing, you failed. And it's like, technically it's a good picture, but you know, you have to bring to life something in the image that you want people to see. And, you know, so you have to identify a subject and you have to, so in portraiture, the key light sets up the basic shadow pattern. So that would be the same thing in a room. If you choose the window light to be the main source, your fill light should be fill light, not overpowering the light source. It should be just fill. So if it starts being brighter than what you originally thought as the key light, then you change you're starting to change the aspect of the photograph. Not that you can't, but just realize that when we're using lights, that, you know, to tell the story, fill light is fill light, and a key light really is what sets up how the shadow should fall in the room.
So Wayne, I know we're running short on time here. Why don't you give our listeners an idea of where they can find your stuff, whether it's your website, on your two different Flickr channels, if you're on social, anything like that. And why don't you give a plug to all your different mediums, if you want to call it.
Yeah. Facebook, I'm Interface Visual. And on Instagram, I'm IFV Images.
Okay. And then we'll also, we'll post a link on the show notes to those two, and as well as the two Flickr channels, one for your Sony and one for all your images. This way everyone can go and follow you and see all your images as well.
Great.
Yeah. And I know from experience and looking at a lot of your work, I know you do a few standing engagements. You've got the rodeo up in Monterey, yes. Is it? Salinas, yeah. Florida. And you do the car, do you do that Elegante, yes, out there? Oh, Concourse
d'Elegante. Yes, there's a whole bunch of car things. Oh, and that's a thing. Do the car thing. Once I got the A6000, I'm literally walking around a car show with a camera on a pole. It is so light. It's amazing. People go nuts to that. Like, huh? Yeah, I could do that with my camera. I do that. I get hired by wedding photographers to do receptions to put the camera on a pole to do the reception to do the dancing.
Wait, do you put a camera on a pole?
Yeah, but doing it. Yeah, I've actually have wedding photographers, again, you know, it's just one of those things, have hire me to light receptions. Since I light a house, doing a reception is easy. And then putting the camera on a pole and shooting down on the dance floor, it's very cool.
It is so cool, and it is so easy. It's such a great part of my photography is pole photography. And I do it a lot at events like you. I do them for a windsurfing contest because I can get above the sail and look down all kinds of perspectives. And it's basically, you know, really important to set your images apart from the others. And if you're sitting in a mash pot with 20 photographers in the pit, how are you going to get something different? Yeah. You know, that's what I like.
Absolutely.
Well, I want to thank you. I got to go run off and do a Twilight shoot, but I want to say thank you so much, Wayne. You were one person that it was hard to get a hold of to finally get into the studio. But I really, really, you lived up to the promise, and I'm just the education that you have that you could put out there for people. It's so accessible, and like you're now like the Ansel Adams for all the new photographers, but I really appreciate all of your help with people and with me especially, and thank you very much for coming on. I hope we can do this again.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, it was great speaking to you, Wayne.
Nice meeting you, Brian.
Likewise.
Okay, it's saying goodbye time for Shooting Spaces, a real estate photography podcast. This is Rich Baum in Sacramento, California.
And Brian Berkowitz here. Rich, go get to your shoot so you're not late.
Okay, guys.
All right.
Talk to you all later. Thank you again, Wayne.
Take it. This has been Shooting Spaces, a real estate photography podcast. Subscribe to the show and don't forget to leave us a review. You can also follow Rich and Brian on social media and at their website, shootingspacespodcast.com.